RN, your world unfolding.
Good evening and welcome once again to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational. Paul Barclay here. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, the myth of progress. Philosopher John Gray questions the view that social progress is incremental, that we're slowly evolving towards a more moral and ethical society. Have we become more civilized with the passing of time? John Gray sees the fragility and warns barbarism is very much alive and part of the human condition. In tonight's lecture, he explains why he sees little progress in the history of ideas. John Gray has held a variety of posts, including Professor of Politics at Oxford, Visiting Professor at Harvard, and Professor of European Thought at the London School of Economics. He now writes full-time. His latest book, which we'll hear him discuss at length on tonight's program, is Silence of the Animals, on progress and other myths. Let's now take a seat at the RSA in London. Here's John Gray.
The book, my new book, begins with a story from Joseph Conrad, a writer I admire very much, and who I in some ways think is one of the greatest 21st century writers, even though he wrote the story that I quote over 100 years ago. But he's a great 21st century writer, and that his subject matter is civilization and barbarism, reason and the attempt to make life more reasonable, against a background of decaying imperialism, contradictory tendencies in Europe, terror, and fanaticism of various kinds. The New Statesman will be having a centenary edition shortly. It was founded in 1913, 100 years ago. And one of the things I think one gets from reading Conrad is how many respects there are in which our situation now is similar in the world to what the situation was in 1913. There have been many changes, some of them for the better. The partial emancipation of women and gays, the development of democracy in many parts of the world, large increases in standards of living for hundreds of millions of people. But other things are the same, although there are different players. Geopolitical struggles for natural resources, wars of ethnicity and territory, the return of religion as a central factor in political and even military conflict. The world is rather like that of, in those respects, that Joseph Conrad wrote about. And the story I mention in the book is one less well-known than Heart of Darkness, but it's based on some of the same experiences which Conrad himself had, and the same phenomena that he witnessed. He went to the Congo, the Belgian Congo, during the period in which he was a seaman, as many of you will know, before he became a full-time writer. And he went out and in connection with taking a job as commanding a boat on a river. And when he was there, he saw what was being done in the Congo under the aegis of Leopold of Belgium, which was one of the great atrocities of the early 20th century. Millions of the inhabitants of the Congo were, their lives were ended or shortened in various ways, which ranged from simple murder to torture, starvation, overwork, something like a genocide, which by some accounts could have accounted for, difficult to tell, but about possibly a fifth of the population were killed. And it was a very formative experience in Conrad's life. And we can read about it, apart from in the story I'm about to mention briefly, we can read about it in the diary he wrote when he was there, and which has subsequently been published, often in editions of Heart of Darkness. And he said, what sort of put me onto this was something he wrote about that. He said, before I went to the Congo, I was a mere animal. I thought that was wonderful, if you reflect on it. What he meant was he was a normal, civilized human being. I was a mere animal. And what he confronted in the Congo was a variety of things which emerge in his later work. One is, if you like, the fragility of civilization, that civilization can be disrupted and break down rather easily, but something perhaps more profound than that, and a rather more troubling insight than that, which is that civilization can itself be at times a vehicle for barbarism. Because the Belgian Congo, the committee which Leopold and his financial backers set up to exploit the Congo, to exploit its peoples and kill them off when they were no longer needed, was called the Committee for Progress and Civilization. And there was a sense in which I think they did, in fact, kind of believe that, some of them to some extent. It wasn't purely cynical. To argue that it was cynical, I mean, if you say that someone is cynical and lies, it's a bit like saying Tony Blair's a liar. I've always found that wildly romantic because it presupposes that he has the taste for truth, which enables him to tell the difference between a lie and something that's true. And I think cynicism of that kind is comparatively rare. So I think they did sort of believe that in some sense they were promoting civilization. And the sense of it is brought out in the story, which is called An Outpost of Progress, one of his lesser known, but very powerful stories, I think. I won't tell the whole story, it's in the book, about two traders who go to Africa, gradually lose their habits of work, lose their identities. They go there believing that they represent a higher civilization, an advancing civilization, one powered by science and knowledge, one which is getting greater and greater power over the material world, and which thereby, in some sense, represents human advance, and that other civilizations or other peoples or other parts of the world in which this hasn't reached yet should be energized by it, incorporated in it, and to the extent that they can't be eliminated. This was a view which H.G. Wells also argued in some of his non-fiction books, such as a book he published in 1902 called Anticipations, non-fiction, not science, wasn't science fiction, which he said those parts of the world which are just sort of incurably inefficient. He didn't sort of mean particular climates, he meant human communities, should be removed, should be dispensed with, or allowed to disappear. A wonderful writer, but he did have these thoughts. So the start of the book is that story, and the reason I started that way is it brings together two things. One is the idea of civilization and its connection with what I call the myth of progress. Now, obviously, the myth of progress that Leopold and his committee held, and which the character were possessed by, and the one that the characters in Conrad's story were also possessed by, was an imperialist myth. It was expressed, the vehicle was a form of imperialism. But the core of the myth was essentially this. The core of the myth, which I think is still strong, is that growth of human knowledge in science and growth of human power through the expansion of knowledge, through the increase of knowledge in technology, is in the long run, over time, linked with growth in civilization or advance in civilization. In other words, there's nothing inevitable in it. It's not deterministic. It doesn't happen entirely by itself. But over time, the growth of knowledge in science is cumulative and irreversible. Over time, it builds up an unstoppable momentum, so that I think it is, in fact, true. This part of the myth is true, or the fact which is invoked in this myth is true, which is that whatever happens in the world today, whatever ecological or other disasters might befall the planet or the human species, we're not going to go back to a period in which universities teach alchemy or astrology. An enormous amount of nonsense is promoted in the interest of science, such as people who think they can become immortal by projecting the information in their brains into cyberspace. But that's not quite the same thing. We're not going to go back to medieval science. That's been left behind. The errors of science, real science, genuine science, the science which has produced the human population the size that it is in the world, the errors don't normally recur and resurface. Errors are usually left behind once they've been falsified, and once the elements in them that are true are incorporated in science, science moves on. They're left behind, as pre-scientific thoughts are left behind. But Conrad believed, and I believe, that in civilization, or if you like, in ethics and politics, this is not the case. Things are learnt in ethics and politics, but they don't stay learnt. The generation of 1945, which constructed peace in Europe, at least half of Europe, and which brought in the Labour government in Britain in set up the post-war settlement, had learnt an enormous amount from the pre-war collapse of civilization in Central Europe and in Europe as a whole. They'd learnt that economic institutions and economic policies could, when tied up with the aftermath of the First World War, could generate results that, as Keynes actually predicted — I'll come back to Keynes towards the end — but as Keynes actually predicted, he said, if the policies that are being implemented coming out of the Versailles Peace Treaty, which he attended as a British delegate, continue, then we'll have a movement of revolutionary barbarism in the centre of Europe. That's sort of more or less exactly what happened when Nazism emerged later, after deflations and inflations and various huge dislocations. So the generation of 1945 had learnt about that. They knew the dangers of how fragile civilization was, and they also knew how terrible, how barbarism could assume modern forms, as it did in Nazism. And they were young enough, many of them, to be able to act on that and build a peace in Europe that lasted a long time. Till now, pretty well, if you put on one side the Balkan Wars. So that can happen, but not for long. The difference between, or one of the differences between progress in science and technology, which is a fact to my mind — I don't take a postmodernist or a relativist view of that, it's just a fact that we know much more than we did in the past and will know much more in the future — the difference between that and advances in civilization is that the lessons that are learnt in ethics and politics are invariably lost and forgotten. So, and I think one of the examples of that, which was the something that happened in the lifetimes of most of everyone in this room, actually, which is the sudden rehabilitation of torture as a legitimate method in warfare, called something different, of course, because most of these evils come back under different names — slavery as human trafficking, for example — the rehabilitation of torture as enhanced interrogation techniques, which occurred coming out of the Iraq War, and occurred, furthermore, not in some tyranny of which we know very little, but in the world's preeminent liberal democracy. So even though torture was prohibited — of course, it had been practiced a lot, but the prohibition was deeply by Britain and other countries in various parts of the world, in Kenya, in Malaya, and Northern Ireland, by the French on a huge scale in Algeria, and by the Americans in Vietnam, just to give some examples — the prohibition was deeply entrenched in international treaties and laws and expectations. And if you'd said 10 years ago that the Vice President of the United States would defend a torture technique, as the Vice President of, as Cheney subsequently did, when he said he didn't regret anything, didn't regret the liberalization of, let's call it the liberalization of American practice on waterboarding — if you'd said that that would happen in 2003, it would have been seen as a perverse exercise in willful pessimism, a misanthropic sort of Swiftian jibe at the idea of progress. But it did happen. And that is essentially the myth of progress. Isn't to do with whether or not things have improved. Things have improved in many respects in the last 100 years. It's to do with the idea that the long-run impact, the myth of progress, that the long-run impact of the growth of human knowledge is to make the world, human life, more civilized. That's the myth. And practically everyone who says they don't believe in this myth do. That's to say, over the long run, there'll be regressions, there'll be dark ages, there'll be periods of stagnation, digression, etc. Over the long run, that's not what happened. Conrad, and I sort of take the view, is that the growth of knowledge, it's very powerful, but what it produces are new forms of civilization, recurrences of old, and new forms of barbarism. So it's not that there is a slow tendency, however weak, however partial, however fallible, however slow, with however many regressions — it's not that there's a slow tendency to make the world more civilized. It's that the growth of knowledge simply enters into the conflicts of the world, the ethical and political and other conflicts of the world, and produces, as I believe it will do in this century that we're in now, it'll produce perhaps new civilizations which are, in some respects, superior to the ones we know, and it will produce new types of barbarism that are worse than the ones that the world currently contains. That's what it does, because although human knowledge grows and increases, human folly and the inner conflicts of the human animal don't change very much. Or you could put it in a different way. Although science is an embodiment of rationality, you might say, what the long-run impact of science in society is not to make human beings more reasonable. It simply enables them to do what they want to do with greater effectiveness. It gives human beings more power. It doesn't give humankind more power because there isn't an entity, humankind, which does things. There are only countless billions and countless millions of human individuals and groups with different goals and values, not only different from each other, but different and conflicting in the same person over a lifetime and at the same time. What science does is enables human beings to implement those values and goals. Now, I'll come to the second point of what I have to say. There is a sort of contrary view to the one I've suggested now, citing Conrad. Much of the book looks, I should say, at the lives of particular people who've been caught in situations where incremental progress, gradual progress, the sort of progress everybody believes in, was impossible. People like Arthur Koestler, in many ways a monster, but an interesting person, who actually lived through the collapse of civilization in Central Europe, traveled extensively in Nazi-occupied Europe and in the Stalin Soviet Union, was an actor in history, not just an observer or a journalist, though he was a journalist at times, and a number of other people who've lived in times where melioristic advance, piecemeal advance, gradual advance, incremental, slow advance, which everyone believes in, wasn't actually possible. I think that was Koestler's insights. One of the reasons that Anglo-American liberals don't like him is that he grasped a central point, which is that incremental advance is possible only in certain relatively rare moments in history. In order to have incremental advance, you have to have background institutions that are more or less legitimate, that people will work in and come to some kind of, having achieved one thing, they'll move to the next kind of thing that they might agree upon or at least reach a compromise on. And for that to happen, you also have to have the main groups in society with sufficiently convergent goals and interests. And that wasn't true in interwar Europe. Politics was polarized, center parties couldn't hold the ring. Most of the social classes had been ruined. And there were new movements of ethnic nationalism alongside revolutionary movements on the left, basically fighting it out. And Koestler understood, I mean, I'm a strong critic of Marx and Marxism, I'm a strong critic of communism, always a strong anti-communist, but I think Koestler's analysis was rational at the time. It was a profound analysis, and he acted upon it and lived on the basis of it and risked his life on the basis of it in many ways. And his analysis was that in Europe at that time, incremental progress was impossible. The only kind of human advance that could occur would be after absolutely cataclysmic conflicts and wars. And in that, of course, he was correct. Now, there is a view nowadays against what I've been saying, which says that societies and even economies and human life in general evolve. In other words, there's a very widespread use now of the ideas of social evolution, that just as the idea is that there's evolution in species of the kind Darwin identified in natural selection, so there is some kind of evolution in society. There are more or less evolved kinds of societies. And this is not, of course, the first time this idea has been popular. 100 years ago, it was hugely popular. 120 years ago, 1890, 1900, 1910. It's absolutely everywhere, this idea. Sell-out books. The books of Herbert Spencer were colossal bestsellers in America. Unfortunately, in connection with some of his ideas, his copyright wasn't enforced, so he got none of the money. That, he was very indignant about that. But it was a tremendously popular idea at that time. And at that time, as now, it suffers from certain fatal kind of difficulties. In the first place, in Darwinian evolution, the whole point about natural selection, it doesn't have a goal of any kind. It's not going anywhere in particular. It's non-teleological. It's a mixture, Darwin said, of... He didn't always stick to this, by the way, but what Darwin said, the core of the theory is it's a mixture of the natural selection of genetic mutations. It's not going anywhere in particular. And also, in... Although, again, Darwin didn't know about this. He didn't know about genes at that time. That came later from Mendel and other researchers. There is in Darwinian biology, Darwinian theory of evolution, there is a sort of unit of selection, which is the gene. A fuzzy unit, but nonetheless one which has a material basis. And there's a mechanism, the mechanism I've just mentioned, which is the mechanism of natural selection of genetic mutations. None of those exists in society. If you really applied an idea of evolution to society, you would have to apply, and you applied it consistently in a Darwinian way, you would have to conclude that societies are going nowhere, which I think is in fact the case. Where they go depends on the multiplicity of human decisions and choices and habits and behaviours in the society, but there are no laws about it. Let me give you an example. The rise of the market economy in China has nothing to do with evolution. It has a lot to do with decisions made by a handful of Chinese leaders 30 years ago. And it's important that that be understood, because if you understand that, you'll also understand that it could be reversed. Not maybe back to Maoism, but circumstances could easily arise of popular discontent or slowdown of growth or whatever, in which the leadership decided on a long period of repression. If you think that there are these, which lots of people do now when they talk about evolutionary economics and other nonsensical expressions. If you think that there is some sort of inexorable or semi-inexorable evolutionary pressure pushing towards global capitalism, which Herbert Spencer, the late 19th century person who actually invented the phrase the survival of the fittest, it didn't come from Darwin, it came from Spencer, he thought that. But he had the great misfortune of living a long time. And by the time he was in his old age, he was seeing not rising free markets, not laissez-faire, but rising imperialism, the Boer War, all the things he hated. And he was sort of, he died in despair. He was intelligent enough to despair, you might say. Now, all these ideas have come back. And there are people who sort of seriously believe or seriously talk as if there is some kind of global evolutionary tendency to free markets and to capitalism. Now, I'll just say sort of two brief things about that and then come to a conclusion. One is, one of the reasons you should be suspicious, if you're interested in this line of criticism or questioning about ideas of social evolution, is you'll find, whenever they're advocated, that social evolution is moving towards the goal that's currently fashionable. So towards the end of the 19th century, it was laissez-faire capitalism. Spencer advocated various... He, by the way, he had a tremendous campaign against public health. He held that the building of sewers and cleansing of waters was a... cleansing of the water was a conspiracy of bureaucrats, and that there was actually no real reason for doing it. I wish he'd written a book I could have done for him called The Myth of Diarrhea. But... So he was a kind of hard case. Then his disciples, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, founded the LSE, where I was, had spent 10 happy years, held to the same view, but then they said, no, this is the 30s by the time they said this. He's absolutely right, Spencer, about evolution, but it isn't that tending towards laissez-faire capitalism. It's tending towards the Soviet Union. That's when they introduced their book, The Soviet Union, A New Civilization, which in the first volume, this is true, had a question mark, A New Civilization, second mark, they took it out. I used to say there was a third volume, very hard to find, which had an exclamation mark, but that's not that's not actually true, so I can't. But there was a second one where it was taken out. Later on, of course, Soviet Union, Some of the horrors of it come out, eventually collapses. You can't really say that it's all tending towards the Soviet Union anymore, so you get people saying instead it's tending towards an idealized version of American capitalism circa about 1987. Fukuyama. Although he didn't use Darwinian arguments, he used more Hegelian ones. Then you have the financial crisis, 2007-2008. So basically what you find is that the local, parochial, temporary, ephemeral conception of what's good and progressive always turns out to be the goal that evolution is pushing towards. 50 years from now, it might be slavery again. If the Nazis had prevailed in Europe, which could have easily happened, thank God it didn't, we might have even had, as it were, arguments. Well, lots of arguments in the 19th century, early 20th century, from German Darwinians such as Haeckel, which is that really if we have a society which respects the truths of evolution, he distorted Darwin, of course, greatly, then it'll be based on immutable racial hierarchies. So what I would sort of... But the fact that this idea has come back leads me to my concluding theme, which is what I start with, which is that errors in human thought in general, in ethics and politics, in human civilization and culture, are not like errors in science. Errors in science don't usually come back. We won't see an article in Nature saying, by God, Nostradamus was right. And just as well that we won't. There are things like creationism, where you can have charity, you could use our parodies of science, but they don't come back. Whereas the exploded fallacies of a previous generation in human thought more generally, in human culture, like this idea of social evolution, always do come back. If you like, if I could use the terminology these people like, they're memes. And the most long-living memes are the most pernicious and usually the most stupid. They're the ones that continually come back. So paradoxically, if you believe in... I think what the revival of ideas of social evolution shows is that there's no progress in the history of ideas. And that's why in my book I kind of conclude by saying, you know, if human rationality was really a scientific theory, if we approached the idea that human beings are even potentially reasonable and rational, and that the increase of knowledge would increase human reasonableness, if we had that, if we treated that as a scientific theory in a truly critical way, we'd have abandoned it and dumped it in the trash can of history a long time ago. Thank you.
Philosopher John Gray at the RSA discussing his new book, Silence of the Animals, on progress and other modern myths. You're listening to Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational. Let's now return to London and the RSA, where John Gray is about to respond to some questions and comments from the audience. To moderate this session and start off the conversation, he's joined by the cultural editor of The New Statesman, John Derbyshire.
You started by suggesting that there are some striking similarities between our time and Joseph Conrad's in geopolitics and political economy and so on. But you also said there have been some striking improvements in the lot of human beings since Conrad's time. Some of those improvements have been technological. We probably enjoy better plumbing than Conrad and his contemporaries did. Mm. We've had television, we now have the internet.
Better dentistry.
And some of that improvement has also been moral and political. You mentioned the changed status of women, gay people, and so on. So I want to start by asking you about moral progress, that second kind of progress. Because some of your critics seem to get very exercised about your claims about the myth of progress. Mm. And I think we've seen some of this in a number of the reviews of the new book. There's a common objection which runs like this, which says that you don't have to believe that tomorrow must be better than today to try to make it so. So in other words, a commitment to improving, however modestly, the lot of human beings need not, patche you, your critics say, need not entail a sort of neo-Christian belief in radical transformation. That's such a common objection that I'd like you to respond to it directly.
Sure. If you could. It's a very common objection, and one that did occur to me when I wrote the book. So I try to answer it in the book, but maybe not clearly enough. The difference is this, that all believers in progress, in piecemeal progress especially, rather than what Orwell called catastrophic gradualism, which is progress in disastrous jumps. He said that in the 30s, many intellectuals became believers in what he called catastrophic gradualism. But if we just think of the kind of progress that liberals believe in, gradual piecemeal progress, assumes that something which I believe to be false, which is that once certain advances have been made in certain areas, democracy has been achieved, the votes for women have been expanded, gays have been given, have been able to assert themselves as ordinary human beings with the same rights and entitlements as others, that against that background, further progress can be achieved. In other words, the idea is that what's been achieved at any one point is relatively fixed, relatively irreversible. Not completely irreversible, but the idea, it's the whole idea of a piecemeal or incremental progress is of step by step, and that presupposes that what was there before remains largely in place. Mm-hmm. But historically speaking, that's not the case, mm-hmm. because even in the history of the 20th century, has been a history, and even in Europe, not to look beyond Europe, has been a period of enormously large discontinuity. If you grew up in Central Europe and were now, shall we say, in your 80s, how many regimes would you have seen? If you're lucky, you might have seen democracy before the Second World War. You might have then had a period of fascism. You might have then had war, followed by communism, then by a post-communist period of market liberal democracy. Now, in the crisis which is swamping countries like, entrapping countries like Hungary and others, a period of darkly poisoned and distorted democracy, followed by who knows what, although I don't think it'll be dictatorship like the 30s, but it could be something pretty awful. So if you actually look at history, I mean, there's a certain kind of gruff, sober, or sort of English or liberals, of course, we've never believed in inevitability, utter nonsense, we've never believed in perfection, never believed in any of this thing. It's quite obvious we can improve matters. Well, of course we can. But the idea of progress is not that things can be made better for a time. That's not the idea of progress. That's just a fact. The Europe in 1990 was a hell of a lot better than Europe in 1940. It's a fact. The idea of progress in which people actually believe, including pretty well all of those who say they don't, is the idea that what has been achieved is sufficiently stable to be the basis for further advance, further progress. And that I hold to be very often, and I would say normally, false. Mm. That as in the case of, who would have, again, 10 years ago, I know this because I argued this 10 years ago, if you'd said, as part of this wonderful war of liberation that we're supposed to be about to wage in Iraq, torture will be used. Now, how could one know that? Well, if you look at what happened in Algeria, colossal amount of, if you look at what had happened, what was already happening to some extent in Afghanistan, it was very likely that torture would be used again. And yet, if you said, and not only that, because there were already voices in America who had written things suggesting a change, suggesting torture warrants. We should have torture, but we should do it in a legal way. We should have techniques, but we should have specialists working in the techniques, not some grubby people in cellars, but professors. They'll be reliable. We can rely on them not to do anything bad. That had already happened, and yet it was held that the prohibition of torture was so deeply rooted, even though wasn't always effective, and often wasn't. It was gone in an instant, and that's much closer to the actual historical experience of most countries. In Britain, we've been relatively lucky, as long as you don't live in Ireland. Been relatively lucky in not having these, not relatively lucky, incredibly lucky. Would have been different, as I say, if the Second World War had ended differently, or if we'd conducted as the British establishment wanted, a shameful peace, and God knows what would have happened after that with Hitler. But I think we've been extraordinarily lucky. But the historical experience of the mass of humankind, even in continental Europe, is not one of cumulative, continuous advance. So that's that kind of obvious, criticism. What I say, so it doesn't get the point. It's not that we can't improve, we can't make things better for a while. It's that what is gained is very easily lost, and in over a longer period will be lost. Doesn't mean it's not worth fighting for. It's like saying it's not worth living because you're going to die. Well, it's not a view I take, even though I think it's fairly well established that I am going to die.
So it's an insistence on the provisional and fragile nature of those improvements, that there's nothing permanent about them.
Yeah, and they're not connected in the way that many people think they are.
And so there's nothing in your argument, in the argument you've just rehearsed, that somehow prevents you, for example, and some of your critics seem to come close to suggesting that it does. There's nothing in what you've said that prevents you, for example, from telling the difference between civilization on the one hand, although you probably wouldn't want to reify it with a capital C, civilization on the one hand and barbarism on the other.
Well, the whole,
But you make a very, I think, interesting... It's a very interesting remark somewhere where you say that we shouldn't think of barbarism as somehow unnatural.
Mm.
That seems to me an absolutely crucial insight.
It's a crucial thing, yeah. I mean, if you ask one of the things, question one can ask, say, first of all, what civilization is. Now, I don't have a single principle or even a family of principles which tells you what civilization is, but I still think it's reasonably, one can tell when something is civilized and when it isn't. I mean, civilization involves restraints, legal and moral, on violence. It involves care for the weak and the frail and the vulnerable. It involves concern for the highest human achievements. It involves avoiding persecution on grounds of religion or sexuality. It involves all those things. People are reluctant to use this language, but to me, flogging a young girl who's been raped for allegedly engaging in, and even if she did, what would necessarily be wrong with that, in premarital sex, is barbarism. Full stop. That's barbarism. Now, I could sort of tease out various reasons why that was. It wouldn't be a single principle, but that's kind of barbarism. But I think, if you look back through history, you can find cultures where there wasn't slavery, cultures where there wasn't torture. I'm not saying they were in every respect better. In other respects, they might be worse than our society. Cultures in which there wasn't patriarchy. But the point I'm labouring is that just as civilization is natural for humans, so is barbarism. That's to say, the idea that people have a kind of instinctual revulsion against living in a barbaric way, that's to say with violence, persecution, fear, threat, revenge, torture. The idea that there's something in us which is stronger than the civilized impulses, I reject. I think they're both in us. Both are natural for us. By the way, that's important, that civilization natural, because otherwise where did it come from? God? The development of civilization is a natural human impulse, but so is barbarism. And if you want to read, very often I find writers of fiction are more useful in this respect than philosophers. But if you want an example of that, in a rather extreme form, then the novel Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, American writer, which is about a period in the Southwest in America towards the end of the 19th century, in which violence wasn't a sort of brief episode, it was a way of life that went on for ages, which whole societies, whole human settlements kind of got used to and participated in. Or to take a different example, it's often been argued, I think there's something in this, if you try and really grasp what the world of Homer was really like, the world of, for example, the Odyssey or the Iliad, if you strip it from the kind of Christianized and moralized interpretations and try and read, it was pretty damn barbaric. It was what we would think of as almost unlicensed barbarism. Of course, in other respects, you might say it was civilized. So they're both, this is an important point, which is that they're both in human beings, so that there'll never be a point at which, there's another argument about progress, in which the appeal of barbarism, which it unfortunately always has, especially in times of stress, there'll never be a point in the human future in which the appeal of barbarism disappears.
I think that's a good moment.
That's an important point.
Invite the audience to join the discussion.
I would just like to say that you said that ancient civilizations like the Greeks didn't have that belief in progress, and it all started from Christianity. So which area of Christianity do you think it came from? Did it come from the Book of Revelations, where there was an end point, a day of judgment?
I'm George, and my question is on the cycles in social evolution, but not in science. could science be seen as a meritocracy which saves it from this cyclicality? Because not every physicist gets to be Einstein, which isn't necessarily the case in social evolution.
Thanks. Three very good questions.
So we've got a question about Steven Pinker's recent book, which you actually reviewed for me, John. That's Scientific Progress. And Pinker's account, a scientist's account of moral progress. We've got a question about the Christian notion of progress. Which era of Christianity are you identifying that with? And then a question about the cycles in social evolution and the different nature of scientific progress.
Three very good questions. I'll try and answer them relatively briefly. I have a number of objections to the sort of Pinker project. One is that the way he does the statistics is pretty narrowly focused on deaths in combat, whereas most of the people who died from the great conflicts of the 20th century didn't die on battlefields. Most of the millions and millions and millions of people who've died in the Congo over the last 20 or 30 years are one of the most humanly destructive successions of conflicts that has ever been, but because it hasn't been absolutely central to Western interests, there are Western interests there in diamonds and gold and other things, but not noticed. Most of them didn't die necessarily by being shot or even machete. They died in various ways, from starvation, cold, illness, and so on and so forth. And that was also true after the First World War. Large numbers of people, or the Russian Civil War, large numbers of people perished through illness. Now, how do you include those deaths? If you include them, as I think they should be included, you've got to start making some moral distinctions about what counts as what the war did and what other factors did. I mean, there are other moral distinctions. It's one thing to die in a battlefield. Terrible if you read about the First World War and how lots of people went out and didn't come back. But in some ways, it seems to be morally worse if you're murdered by your own government and you're murdered in secret, or your mother or father or children or family members vanish. And subsequently, Freud didn't live long enough to find out what had happened to his two aged sisters who didn't leave Austria when he did, because they thought, as aged old ladies who took no part in politics, they'd be safe. They both perished at the hands of the Nazis. So it seems to me that some kinds of murders are morally worse than others. And that relates to a different question, which is, I don't see that numbers can tell us all that much. I mean, supposing the human population were to double in size, but the number of people who died in, under some Pinkerian definition of warfare, the numbers remained the same, the actual numbers, but they were a smaller percentage. You say, well, the percentage of people died has gone down by half. Staggering. And sort of a march to peace, yes. I wouldn't find it like that. I mean, I think, or take yet a different example, we now know, some of you will have read this, I believe it to be true, that the reason there wasn't a thermonuclear war, which it easily could have been, at the time of Cuba, the Cuban crisis back in the early 60s, was that a single human being, a deputy commander of a Soviet submarine, refused to take a certain decision. One human being. And people who've studied it, I'm not an expert, say that. If he hadn't done that, there could very well have been a thermonuclear war, in which maybe how many would have perished? All the Pinkerian numbers would be rather different, wouldn't they? 100 million down the tubes pretty quickly. And then the chaos, the breakdown of humans, of production and distribution and illness and horrible deaths. I mean, multiply Hiroshima and Nagasaki by 100 or 200. That's what you would get. That was one human being. So where's the great inexorable sort of progression going on? You know, he was just, by the way, when he got back, he was treated as like dirt. He was treated as almost a traitor. So I don't take it seriously, and I haven't, and I also find it slightly offensive in certain ways, the theory, because what he says is that wars, kind of dirty old wars, they're really associated with backward periods of civilization. And I ask myself, and in my review I mentioned this, was that true, for example, in Southeast Asia, which had 30, 40 years of war after the Second World War, which ravaged the whole continent? Was that because they were stuck in some backward period of civilization? Or was it because there were repeated Japanese, French, American neo-colonialist wars? What was the reason? Well, they just couldn't get out of their Buddhistic lethargy, except by war, launch themselves into frenzies of killing to get out of this kind of trap of tranquility in which they'd sunk. No, it was because there were terrible neo-colonial wars, which, if you read one of my favorite writers, much in the book, Norman Lewis, he traveled there in the early 1950s. He traveled all over many parts of Southeast Asia at the rather refined and subtle and in some ways, I would say, superior civilization that existed there at that time, which he thought would be destroyed in wars that then, in fact, happened. So I find the kind of the message of Pinker's book, as well as intellectually flawed, I find it morally offensive, if that is the message and it's what he says. Christianity and progress. It's true. I think in the ancient world, you know, they imagined better states of society, but mostly in the past. That's to say, it isn't true that they didn't have myths of... They had a mythical view of history, but the better period is in the past. By the way, I want to resist that too. I'm not one of those who think there was some point everything was okay. You know, sort of modernity broke out in 1252. If only that had not happened, we'd be fine. If you look back at medieval Europe, it was a period of completely unremitting warfare and slaughter. Decade after decade of it. And also periods of... It's a wonderful book by Barbara Tuchman, marvelous American historian, which is about a period in early modern times in France and which absolutely everything was for sale. You know, salvation, if you could afford it. Every religious indulgence, everything. So, you know, our present situation is not unprecedented. When did it happen? I don't know. My book, Black Mass, tries to go into this in some detail and say when these ideas of history, not just of eschatological, apocalyptic ideas that the world ends, but the idea of history having a kind of, being a single, coherent, continuous story, a kind of narrative, and in particular a narrative of sin and redemption. Now, of course, in secular thinking, it's not called sin and redemption, it's called error. And the idea is that we gradually get less erroneous. Gradually, human beings, just as I say, errors in science, errors in scientific thinking are gradually eliminated and we get closer to the truth, so that in ethics and politics we gradually eliminate errors. As I've said, I don't believe that to be true. Probably, I mean, who invented Christianity? In my view, it wasn't Jesus. It was St. Paul. Not one of my favorite people. Even though I'm more sympathetic to Christianity than I am to the forms of secular humanism that came after it. Science as a type of meritocracy, well, in some respects it obviously is, because scientists can talk to each other from all parts of the world. They can talk to each other and compare the results of experiments in ways that religions find difficult, and even difficult ethical viewpoints find difficult. So there's one sense in that. But on the other hand, let me go back to what I was talking about just as an example. Before the Second World War, from about the late 19th century, second half of the 19th century onwards, up to the First World War, and then in the interwar period, eugenicist ideas, racist forms of biology were very, very strong. Not only in Nazi Germany and not only in the interwar period, but in Britain and in the latter part of the 19th century, in the whole of Europe, they were very, very strong. There was even some of them entered into law. There was craniometry. Have you heard about that? It was that certain types of cranial structure were associated with criminality. So beware if you end up with big ears or something like that, then you're going to be banged away for about a couple of decades if you come up for an offence. They were very, very strong. Now, the interesting thing for me is that these kind of ideas and the associated eugenicist ideas of improving the stock of humanity by eliminating so-called inferior elements, they weren't defeated within the context of science. They were strong, I think, right up to the start of the Second World War. They were defeated by the military defeat of Nazism, which showed what, even then, by the way, it wasn't complete or immediate. I think it's true that the post-war election manifesto referred to one of the goals of a conservative government is improving the genetic stock of the nation. So, but they were set back. They'd never gone away completely. But were they set back by progress in science, meritocracy? No, they were set back by a military defeat. If the defeat hadn't happened, for one reason or another, I bet they would still be around. Let me kind of conclude by, I said I would mention Maynard Keynes, and I will. He's a wonderful writer. In 1938, he gave a talk, I think it was 38, called My Early Beliefs, which was published after the war and after he died, as a little essay. And even supremely, I would love, I knew Hayek, but I obviously never knew Keynes. I'd love to have known Keynes. And in the talk, he described a certain view, which I think is still very common, as being his early view, and the view he attributed to Bertrand Russell. He said, Bertie, he said, brilliant man, Bertie, he said he believed two completely incompatible things. On the one hand, he believed that human history up till to date was a story of crime, folly, and atrocity. He said, but Bertie thought the cure was simple. Human beings should just start being more reasonable. And I think that view is sort of quite common now. And what Keynes went on to say, I think this is sort of a rather deep thing. He said the distinction which is commonly drawn between ideas of inevitability of progress or progress to perfection or utopianism on the one hand and piecemeal improvement on the other hand, meliorism it's often called, is a mistake, he says, because what meliorism assumes is that human beings are already advanced enough to be swayed by reasonable argument. Now, why did he, Keynes, abandon that view? What led him to it? I think it was a particular experience. Robert Skidelsky is the great scholar on Keynes, so I would bow to him on this, but I think this is the reason. When he went to Versailles as a member of the British delegation, he assumed that one of the main functions of that meeting, if not the main one, was to deal with famine on the European continent. Because although we forget about it after about 1918, 1919, there was famine or near famine all over Europe, in lots of parts of Europe. So he assumed that's what it would be about. And he assumed they would come together, these great men and a few women at that time, and discuss how to deal with it. He found that what they were interested in was scoring points off each other, punishing the Germans. They weren't at all interested in famine. And in fact, he went to bed for 2 weeks, I read. He sort of had a mini nervous breakdown. And came out. He did see Marcel Proust in a doorway, so that might have made it all worthwhile to him. But he changed his view at that point. And he took the view then, as he said in this wonderful essay, he said, we believers in the Bloom's group, we were kind of we were like dragonflies flying about over a pond with strong, powerful currents underneath. We didn't realize how strong they were and how difficult they were to deal with. And so that, in a sense, is part of the burden of my book, although, like Keynes, I don't expect to convert anyone. Thank you.
Extremely significant.
Philosopher John Gray, his new book, Silence of the Animals, on Progress and Other Modern Myths, is published by Alan Lane. Our thanks to Simon Field and the RSA in London for making that recording available to us. And that's it for tonight. Tomorrow we're in Sydney for highlights of last weekend's TEDx. Topics include space junk as heritage, how difference in Australian society has been overstated, new thoughts on food security, and why a solar activist now embraces the profit motive. That's TEDx Sydney tomorrow night on RN at 8, or download anytime. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.